Welcome to episode 130 of Tea or Books. I'm Simon.
I'm Rachel.
And this is the podcast where we debate the difficult decisions of reading and books. In this episode, we're not doing the two books we said at the end of the last episode. We're doing one of them. We're doing Babbicomes by Susan Scarlett, also known as Nell Stretfield. We are not comparing it with High Wages by Dorothy Whipple because, as someone pointed out, we've already talked about it. Thank goodness someone was paying attention. So instead, we are going to do The Lady's Paradise by Emile Zola. Yes, which I'm looking forward to talking about those. And in the second half, no, sorry, that is the second half. In the first half, we will be talking about romantic plots. Does a book need a romantic storyline?
Yes.
Before we get to those, before I ask you what you're reading, Rachel, I will remind people or tell people for the first time if they didn't hear the last episode that we will be appearing at the Marlborough Literary Festival in Wiltshire on September the 29th, talking about British Library Women Writers series, and we would love you to come.
We would. I mean, please come. We want people there.
Yes.
Don't make us walk to an empty room.
Please. If you just Google Marlborough Literary Festival and look up the schedule, that's probably the best way. I'll put a link in the notes on stuckinabook.com, but that might be simplest. And if you're a Tea or Books listener and you come along, do let us know. We'd love to say hello.
Yes.
And Rachel, what are you reading?
Well, I've read an awful lot. I can't remember. When did we do our last recording?
Oh, about 6 weeks ago, I think. So it's been a while.
So I've been on my summer holidays. I'm going back to work tomorrow, so it's can't actually believe it. But I've been around and about, been to lots of places. I've been to Switzerland, Denmark, England, New York. I've travelled. And so I've read a lot. I've had a lot of plane journeys. And I'm just trying to think what I would pick out as my top ones, really. I'm halfway through two books at once, which I don't normally do, but they're long non-fiction ones. I like to actually read non-fiction during the summer because it's when I've got time to actually sort of absorb it a bit more, and I can read in longer chunks, which means that I can take on board things. So one of the books is not something I would ever ordinarily pick up, but I'm actually really, really enjoying it. So I will recommend this to people. It's not going to be a typical choice for us, but a colleague at work lent it to me probably about 6 months ago. So yesterday, I really need to read this because I have to give it back to him when I go back to school, because otherwise it's embarrassing and he keeps mentioning it. So it's called The Spy and the Traitor. And it's a real story of a KGB spy called Oleg. I can't remember his last name now. I've been reading it all day. It begins with G. It's complicated and Russian. who was working for the KGB and then became the most prominent, well, actually one of the only at the time, secret agent working to spy for the British. So he was passing on Soviet secrets to the British during the Cold War. And it's the true story of how he worked and how he managed to evade detection, and how he worked with the, because he was a really prominent member of the KGB. So he was running this terrible risk. And the way that it's written is so engaging that it kind of reads almost like fiction, because this stuff, you feel like this can't be true, like people don't live like this, but clearly they do. And so I'm really, really enjoying that. And it's by Ben McIntyre, who's a journalist in the UK, and he's written quite a few books, actually. He wrote Operation Mincemeat as well, which has now become a really big musical over here. I don't know if it's made it to the States yet. It might have done. Which is all about a World War II kind of decoy operation. So, yeah, I'm really enjoying that. So I'm halfway through, as I say, and I'm also halfway through Arthur Miller's autobiography, Time Bends, which I've been meaning to read for years. He's my favourite playwright. I love him so much. My students roll their eyes every time I mention his name because I managed to get him a lesson no matter what we're doing. And I'm just absolutely loving it. I took it with me to New York thinking, oh, this is great because I've got all this time on the plane to read. And this book's like 600 pages long and has been sitting on my bedside table for 2 years. And I haven't finished. So I started reading it, and I knew but kind of didn't know at the same time that Arthur Miller grew up in Brooklyn, and so reading it while I was actually in New York was really lovely, and I'm finding it fascinating. And he kind of jumps around in time a lot, which is why it's called Time Bends, which kind of reflects his circular way of thinking about time. But I'm really enjoying that. Highly recommended. And not just if you're interested in playwriting, but he also just has had a fascinating life. So really enjoying that. Fiction-wise, I have been on a mission this year to read my way through George Orwell's work. We read The Clergyman's Daughter as one of our books a couple of episodes ago that you didn't like, but I did. And this time I read Keep the Aspidistras Flying, which is one of his later novels, and is about a man who is a kind of clerk and working class, and his socialist beliefs prevent him from getting on in life. And I read it on the plane journey to somewhere, I can't remember where I was now. I enjoyed it very much, but I found it quite, I don't know, there was a pessimism to it. I mean, I know that he was writing it while he was dying, so that's probably why. But it's still brilliant. I mean, the way George Orwell writes is just fabulous, but I found it quite, yeah. I don't know. I didn't feel like I'd want to read it again, but I was glad that I'd read it.
Yeah, I read that one a few years ago. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. It was one of my favourite reads that year, but I couldn't stand the main character. I can't remember his name now, but he was so selfish and sort of using his ideology to ruin everyone else's life and refusing help from people who could afford to help him and demanding help from people who couldn't afford to help. But I think we were meant to find him quite annoying. I hope we were.
Beautifully written. I like to think that George Orwell was sort of making the point that having ideals is all very well, but ultimately the world isn't set up to support you in that, and you do have to capitulate in some way in order to make yourself comfortable, which then I suppose is difficult to live with if your values don't align with the world in which you live. But there we are. But yeah, really good. So I've had lots of good reads actually, and two of which we will be talking about on this episode anyway, so I won't talk any further about those. But yeah, that's been me. And what about you?
Well, you're not the only one who's travelled, Rachel. Since we last spoke, and I've been to Scotland. So
beautiful.
Yes. Well, I went to Inverness and the Cairngorms, and then the North Coast and Orkney.
Oh, I've never been to Orkney. What's it like?
No, I haven't been north of Edinburgh before, I don't think. The landscape is beautiful and the houses are ugly, was my conclusion. It's just unpainted pebble dash as far as the eye can see. It was very bleak, but beautiful. Beautiful landscape and coastline, and sadly didn't see any puffins, which is what I was hoping to see, but I did really like the trip. And we drove up the east coast. That was very beautiful. The Cairngorms beautiful. So it was a lovely time. And I also went to Keswick in the Lake District with work, I've been going up to the north a lot, and that obviously is very beautiful, as is all the Lake District. It was my third time working at the Keswick Convention, which is, for those who don't know, a Christian festival where my work has a stand, and both trips were also times where I could do quite a lot of reading. I'll pick a couple of books that I really enjoyed. One I read in Keswick, which was The Stone Diaries by Carol Shields, which I really loved.
Years ago.
Yeah, Deborah, who is a listener to Teal Books and whom I met in Toronto, gave me a copy because obviously Carol Shields is Canadian. She wanted to introduce me to Canadian authors I hadn't read. And I've known of Carol Shields, but I haven't read her. And this basically tells the story of the main character whose name I've forgotten, Stone, from her birth through her long life. And it's told in a very unconventional way, often sort of going between third and first person, and sometimes having more knowledge than the reader, sometimes having the same level of knowledge of the reader. It's quite unusual in a way that doesn't feel like showing off or overly experimental, or it's still a page turner. I really enjoyed, really fascinating characters, really interestingly written. So that was really fun. Did you like it when you read it?
I did, very much so. I remember reading it when I worked in the library, so I must have been at university, and they were getting rid of loads of copies of Carol Shields' work. I don't know why. Mm. So I took loads of them and read them. I went through a whole phase of just reading all of her books, and I've never reread them since. So actually, I will add that to my reread list.
Yeah. And I would like to read more. I know the other two I've heard of are Unless and Larry's Party, so I don't know if there's one that you or anyone else would particularly recommend that I read by her.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. No, I can't remember now, but I'm sure other people will be very widely read.
And then nonfiction. I really enjoyed when I was in Scotland a book called Rereadings, which is edited by Anne Faderman, that my brother gave me for my birthday in 2010. So I finally read it. It was a collection of essays from a journal. I forget the name of the journal, but they were basically all different authors or different writers of some variety writing about their experience of rereading books that they loved when they were younger. I'd only read a couple of the books mentioned. Pride and Prejudice is mentioned, and the Letters and Journals of Catherine Mansfield are mentioned. There's various authors that I've read, you know, Evelyn Waugh and D.H. Lawrence and Conrad and Knut Hampson, and then various people I've never heard of, like Enid Starkey and H.C. Witwer, and but what makes them really good, these essays, is they're really just about the person writing them, about, you know, how they've aged. Most of them seem to be maybe in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and talking about books they read when they were in teenagers or early 20s. So they're looking back over quite a substantial amount of life, some of them. Again, the people who wrote the essays, I've only heard of Vivian Gornick. I don't know who any of the other people are. So it's not populated by, to me, very renowned authors, but I found it absolutely fascinating. I learned a bit about the books that I hadn't read before, but more than that, I loved how seriously they took writing about reading and writing about how reading experiences can reflect their maturity in their life and their nostalgia or their regret, all these different things. So it's a really wonderful collection, Rereadings by Anne Faderman, who is most, or best known, I think, for writing Ex Libris, which a lot of us probably have enjoyed at some point.
Yes, I like her. Well, how funny. Yeah, that sounds a really kind of intriguing way of looking at how different writers sort of process things. And nice, I love it when stuff like that is all brought together in one place.
Yes, and it made me think, because it seems that this was a weekly column or a monthly column for a very long time. So I wonder what happened to all the other ones. I want to read rereadings too. But I mean, I got this for my 25th birthday and I'm 38 now, so I finally have read it. So there's no rush, Anne, for the next volume.
You know what? Everything comes in its time.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, there we are.
And let's talk romance. So this is a suggestion from Lindsay. Thank you. Lindsay sent lots of suggestions. We're very grateful for that.
Thank you.
Yes. And, well, I think she asked romantic novels versus novels with a romantic storyline, but we thought, let's twist that a bit and say, do novels need a romantic storyline to really work? Do you want to kick us off, Rachel?
Yeah, I suppose I sort of thought about it in terms of the books that we've just read, actually, for the podcast. So both of these books, Babbicombe's and The Lady's Paradise, are ostensibly about supposedly shops. Ultimately, while that is the kind of premise, I think the real heart of both of those books and what maybe keeps you reading, depends on who you are, we could discuss more later, is the interpersonal relationships. And at the heart of both of the books is a kind of will they, won't they, lesser in Babbicombe's maybe, story about two people who are from very different backgrounds, and, you know, will they get together? And I was thinking to myself, would I have found the books as interesting if they didn't have that romantic plot line? And I thought, actually, for me, with The Lady's Paradise, I probably would have done, because there was enough meat on the bones about the actual workings of the shop and the business side of things. And it made me think, do we sometimes sacrifice other elements of life and what we might find interesting for a romantic plot, because the belief is that a book can't be carried without one. And actually, staying on this theme of shops, if we think about high wages, for example, which we were going to read for this, I think what's so unique and quite inspiring, really, about high wages is that this will be a bit of a spoiler, so don't listen if you haven't read it, is that she, the main character, Jane, doesn't end up in a romantic relationship, and she chooses to be by herself. And really, the thrust of the book is about her growing as a businesswoman and her developing the acumen to run a shop for herself and the ins and outs of how the business of clothes selling is changing over time. And that's her ambition for herself, and her ambition for her business is what she's in love with throughout the book. And it's quite a rare example for me where a book hasn't hinged on a romantic relationship, but has still been really compelling to read. And I personally would like to read more books like that, because I actually quite struggle to think of any examples where romance or the potential of romance isn't at the heart of a story. But I'm sure you'll have plenty of examples.
Well, when I was thinking about romance novels in general, I've said on the podcast before that I've in the last couple of years got quite into sort of rom-commy type audiobooks, which are, you know, fairly disposable, and they're all more or less the same. And those are very much like romance is the whole plot in the way that they often are in a rom-com, or there might be some side plots, but the romance is the main plot. And that I quite appreciate. Generally, I often find that a romance plot feels a bit tacked on to a novel, as though, you know, they feel they have to, or feel like got to tick a box. I often have mentioned Babbitt by Stella Givens on the podcast before, which the first half, about two spinsters who set up a boarding house, absolutely glorious, loved it to pieces. Second half, this love triangle between sort of quite tedious, self-involved people, just incredibly boring. So that's an example, a very glaring example of something that I've noticed more often, and that often I do find the romantic element of a novel the least interesting part. And I was trying to think of some novels that I love that don't have romance, and I found it actually a bit easier when I was thinking back to the 1920s. So I think like Lolly Willows, which we've covered on here, about a woman who, again, spoilers, becomes a witch. It's about her independence. That's the sort of quest, not romantic partner, very much not a romantic partner. Similarly, The Love Child by Edith Olivier that we've also discussed on here, that's about someone fulfilling their dream to be a mother, which they haven't been. So there's, you know, relationships are very important, but just not romantic relationships. And then, of course, there are books where, you know, there's no real chance of romance, because, or at least no one hopes for a chance of romance, because the characters are long settled into marriage. And I was thinking of as I often do, of the Diary of a Provincial Lady series, where, you know, she's a housewife and mother, and, you know, there's no spark of romance with her husband. You get the suspicion that perhaps there never much was. And there's a scene in the second book, Provincial Lady Goes Further, which is when they're on holiday in France, and she's on this bus going towards Dinard, and there's a man she never speaks to, but she just refers to him as the moustache, who she's clearly got a bit of, she clearly fancies him, essentially. I'll just read a bit. The moustache and I look out of our respective windows, but from time to time turn around. This exercise, not without a certain fascination, should be very sorry indeed to recall in any detail peculiar fantasies that pass through my mind before dinner is reached. Bus stops opposite casino. The moustache and I rise simultaneously. Unfortunately, bus gives a last jerk and I sit violently down again, and all is over. Final death blow to non-existent romance is given when Robin's white shorts, now in the last stages of dirt and disreputability, slide out of inadequate paper wrapping and are collected from floor by bus conductor and returned to me. And I think that's a great example of the tone that Delafield has in these books. She does do romance in other books, but in these books, even the idea of a romantic storyline is slightly ridiculous, and she's much more about self-deprecating humour and sort of piercing the balloon of romantic aspirations. And, you know, it's unlikely for that character to have had an affair or anything, but even the idea of an affair is immediately punctured by her son's dirty clothing falling onto the ground. And that's the sort of thing that I maybe look for more in a novel than the sincerity of a romantic storyline.
Yeah, and I think I'm interested in certainly that period of literature as well, the kind of explorations of interiority and also explorations of kind of seismic events. So, you know, I love fiction from World War One and World War Two, where, you know, romance is obviously not on the cards for anybody really, if they're at the front or whatever, and you're getting those kind of real life first person accounts of what it's like to experience something totally outside of the ordinary and something that's completely I suppose overwhelmingly different to the life that you would have had before. And often you have sneaked moments in these novels of kind of relationships or trying to continue on a relationship, but that's not really the thrust of the book. The thrust of the book is often staying alive, you know, the work that you're doing and kind of recounting what the experience was like. So thinking of, you know, The Heat of the Day by Elizabeth Bowen, or something like Rose Macaulay's what's the name of it, you know what I mean, with the
which one,
the one where there were the children in the ruins,
The World by Wilderness.
Yeah, those sorts of books where they are romance. There might be elements of relationships in the books, but really the exploration is about society and social change. Thinking about, Margarita Lasky as well, her novels are really good on social change and don't tend to be as fixated on romantic plots. I mean, Little Boy Lost, I think, is one of the most compelling novels I've ever read, which is all about a man's search for his missing son.
And then when she did get all romantic, it was under a pseudonym, wasn't it? To Bed with Grand Music was written under a pseudonym. Yeah.
And that really interesting as well, sort of anti-romantic, isn't it? That she's looking...
That's true, romance is a bit of a euphemism for that one.
Yeah. Looking for sexual encounters as opposed, you know, and the excitement of the fleetingness rather than looking for something lasting, which again is very reflective of the psychological impact of war, I suppose. And someone like Virginia Woolf, for example, she, if we discount her early novels, which I think she probably would have done herself, looking at her experimental work that's so focused on the experience of being and wanting to write about that experience of being and thinking about the multitude of different engagements our brain has with the world around us and with other people in it on a day-to-day basis. And my favourite of her novels is actually her last one, which is Between the Acts. And that doesn't have romance in it at all. And The Waves, for example, is just that wonderful experiment into The Lighthouse. You know, there's no romance in that. So for me, like the books that have probably had the most profound effect on me as a reader and thinking about language and the use of language and the experimentation of fiction and how it conjures up a sort of era or a time don't have romance in them at all. And I do enjoy them the more for it. But then, you know, we all know that my favourite novel of all time is Emma by Jane Austen. And
you know, bring the clacks in, everyone. take a drink.
Jane Austen is my favourite novelist, and she couldn't be called anything really other than, I would say, a romantic novelist. Her novels are all about romance and love and finding a partner. So...
Oh, well, I'm going to copy that. I mean, I think the adaptations of her books were all about that, but I think the novels were about self-knowledge and the romance just sort of comes along the way.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that, but I think the problem is the characters spend most of their time thinking and talking about romance, don't they? Or not necessarily about romance, though. Yeah. I mean, maybe actually let's argue the point on that, because is it romance? Or is it the desire to be married and what that status gives you as a woman? I think there's probably more of that social contract in the novels itself. I mean, obviously, you know, the characters do fall in love, etc. But, I mean, Mansfield Park is not romantic in my view at all, because, I mean, who would want to get married A, to your cousin, B, to your cousin who has treated you like a child for the entirety of the novel and decides in the last paragraph that actually maybe he does love you after all. But there's the wonderful romance of Pride and Prejudice at the heart of that. I think that's her most overtly romantic novel, but I do get swept up in it and I do love it. So I don't know, I'm a creature of contradictions. My novel is Jane Eyre.
You know, I think there's certainly pre-Victorian, there is, you know, romance is often, or at least some sort of romantic storyline is often central, but in an era where a man and woman could not get to know each other unchaperoned or yes. particularly talk to each other before they were engaged, it is a sort of weird mix of, yeah, the romance is the whole thing, but they don't really have a romantic engagement with each other. They're just, you know, someone proposes after half an hour or something, and then that's the end of the book. Eventually there's some sort of obstacle or something. You don't tend to see people really exploring each other's psyches in the same way in something like, I don't know, something by Fanny Burney or something by I know Mary Brunt and all these people who are around just before or around the time of Jane Austen. It's about the marriage plot, but it's not really about romance, I think.
No, and I think, you know, Jane Austen is exploring the idea of what does it mean to marry and what does it mean to love and how important is that at a time of social change. So, I mean, her novels are social novels and as much as they are romance novels, because she's exploring what was important to people of her time. I think it's really interesting that in recent years, romance novels, you know, chick lit, as we might call it, as marketers would call it, is enormously popular, and all of those novels are all about romance, and they're not novels that I read, so I can't comment on them, but I know that, you know, just from looking in the bookshops or in the library or in the charity shops, you know, they're everywhere and people clearly love them, and those books hinge entirely around a boy meets girl, girl meets boy plot, and will they get together? And they would have nothing else in them if that wasn't, you know, part of it, which to me is kind of, for, I find that problematic, but clearly a lot of people do love it.
Yeah, it's interesting how the absence or presence of a romantic storyline has been seen to be a marker of literary quality over time, because, you know, I don't think anyone had a problem with there being a romantic element in a Victorian novel. It was sort of just accepted that they'd be there. I mean, something, you know, like Trollope, who doesn't particularly foreground romance in the novels I've read, but you know, there's often elements there. And then you get, yeah, the people like Virginia Woolf in the mid 20th century, where I think there probably was a sense that they wanted to get more interiority, more about, you know, the individual, less about the romantic storyline. But then you fast forward to now, and, you know, I'm trying to think of some of the well-respected names of today, like Zadie Smith or Ian McEwan or Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. All these people, you know, there will be a romantic element to their novels, and nobody thinks that that's a negative thing. Well, maybe some people do, but it doesn't. No one's worried that that element in a book will make it look bad. If it is the only thing in a book, as you're saying, then probably people will be suspicious. But even then, something like, you know, Sally Rooney, those books are basically just straight romances, aren't they? I mean, they're about characters as well, but but if they were considered to be less well written, they could easily masquerade as, you know, ten a penny. Cheap romance. It's just the fact that they're well written rather than for what their theme is that marks them out as being, you know, in a sort of different literary category.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And somebody, I was reading an article, I can't remember who wrote it, he was saying that the books written by women about romance, you know, are considered to be not worth reading and crap and would never get nominated for a literary prize. But then when men write books about romance, they're given the Booker Prize. And there's a real kind of gender split in the way that it's looked at. Woman writing about romance equals chick lit. Man writing about romance equals incredibly insightful. And it's interesting that we also have that dichotomy going on where we judge romance to be less worthy of reading about if it comes from a woman's pen than a man's, and I wonder why that is. Well, I mean, I can think of lots of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, probably just good old-fashioned misogyny, I guess.
But... yeah, we don't need to derail talking about that. But I think it's the presence of or the prominence of romance and the judgment of how that's perceived in terms of quality is something that certainly has got much more prominent nowadays. I think in the past, romance was certainly something that was just an accepted part of novel writing because it was there from the very beginnings of the convention, really. You know, it was just that's what novels are for. You write about romance. You write about relationships between people. That's what novels are about. And as the form progressed and writers started wanting to use the novel form as a form of experimentation and a challenge to what we could write about and a whole breadth of human experiences, you have more diversity. But it is interesting to me, certainly in young adult fiction, that it's my friend who writes young adult fiction as a published writer, says to me, you know, the agents won't try and sell anything unless it's got a romance plot in it.
And I wonder if that's partly an eye on the Netflix money or, you know, the potential adaptation.
But, you know, because there are authors who've wanted to really sort of say, well, can we focus on friendship? Can we focus on other forms of relationships? And no, it's like, no, if it's not got a romance in it, it will not sell. And that's really interesting as well to think about, you know, how much of it is what writers want to write and how much of it is what readers want to read. That dictates the market.
Yeah. Well, we should probably come to our teal book's decision making time. Does a novel need a romantic storyline?
Well, me, absolutely not, no. And most of the time I think it's better without one.
And I also certainly don't think it needs one. And you know, it's certainly if I'm seeing on the back of a novel that it is about romance, then or includes a very heavy romance storyline, then it's a turn off for me. I'm much more interested in other aspects of people's lives.
Yeah, I think it's important that other aspects of people's lives are given more prominence in fiction because it's not the only thing we should be interested in. But there we are.
Thank you, Lindsay. We got a question for the middle section that we'll probably have to be quite speedy about answering this one because it could become big. And I know that you are an expert in this field. So so we might get you to talk a bit about that as well. But the original question from Michelle is, what set books did we read at school? And I think we're going to talk about whether we liked them, whether it set us off reading those authors briefly, but then maybe you can talk a bit about your work in that area.
Oh, yes. Well, I have to say they haven't changed an awful lot from what's still studied in books nowadays. So when I was at school, for my GCSEs, like when I forgot and lost in the midst of time, I did the Far From the Madding Crowd by Thomas Hardy, which I hated. Lord of the Flies, which I loved. And Inspector Calls, which I did very much enjoy. My mum took me to see the play in London. It's my first time I think I'd seen a play in London. We would have done some poetry, but I couldn't tell you what it was. I feel like potentially war poetry. No, actually, do you know what? I didn't do an Inspector Calls in my GCSE. I did Journey's End because I remember us all crying in class. Oh. we read it out loud and, you know, all of us reading a play about World War One, what do you think is going to happen to the characters? Obviously, none of us thought that far ahead. So we were in floods at the end. Oh, no. So it was, yeah, that's what I did for GCSE. And for A-level, I did Emma and Pride and Prejudice, which is where my lovely English teacher, Mrs. Hitchcock, who was wonderful, is wonderful, she's still alive, gave me my real passion for Jane Austen there. So that was a gift. I also did Beloved by Toni Morrison, which traumatised me. And I've never been able to read Toni Morrison since because that book upset me so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't do any of those books. Oh. So there you go. I did, at GCSE, I did Of Mice and Men, John Steinbeck. which I sort of liked. And it's only in recent years that I really discovered my love for John Steinbeck, particularly, well, the ones that aren't the sort of big American novel ones. So I've read Winterfell is Content and Cannery Row in recent years and love those. I did do an Inspector Calls, which I enjoyed. And I can't remember what else I did at GCSE, but at A-level I did Hard Times by Charles Dickens, which set me off loving Dickens. I was the only one in the class who, I think possibly the only one who finished it, but certainly the only one who enjoyed it, including the teacher. After we finished, he said, I can now admit to you that I don't like Dickens. I thought, well, that's a good teacher who has made me love it even when he doesn't. Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Brooks. And Translations by Brian Friel, which we compared with The Tempest. By obviously Shakespeare. And then the one I least favourite thought was absolute trash, Captain Crowley's Mandolin by Louis de Bernier. Yeah. A complete waste of time. It's like, why are we studying this book? There are so many books in the world and we're just doing this bit of sort of trashy beach literature.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think. Actually, I did Dr. Faustus as well.
Oh, gracious.
I loved that.
Yeah, obviously we did lots of Shakespeare beyond. Yes, all Shakespeare all the time. Yeah. But Rachel, I believe you have some intel about what people read in schools today.
I do. So I am part of a soon-to-be charity, actually, one of the founders. We're just going through the charity process at the moment of an organisation called End Sexism in Schools. And we carried out the first research into what is actually studied in English schools. Largely to look at it from a gender perspective. And we discovered that the vast majority of children in the UK never study a book by a female author or playwright. And 2% of students at GCSE, which is our compulsory exams that you do when you're 16, study a book by a woman. So, or a play. So the figures are pretty stark, really, there. And that's because the same books dominate the choices that teachers make and have remained the same for many years. So the most popular books to study at GCSE are A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens and An Inspector Calls by J.B. Priestley, also because they are the shortest on the set text list. And one of the big challenges, for those of you who don't know English, I was banging this drum because I think it's really important people understand, English is the only subject that has two GCSEs. And in the vast majority of schools, you don't get given any more curriculum time than any of the other subjects. So you're trying to teach two qualifications in the same time as one. So it's really challenging for English teachers because you have to really make choices on how long the texts are, which is why the short ones get taught.
You're doing language as well as literature.
You're doing language and literature at the same time. So it's, and both of which are quite demanding qualifications with a lot to cover. So it's hard work. And in the younger years at school, most people, again, the most popular novel is A Christmas Carol. And so a lot of children are studying the same book twice. And you're also having Of Mice and Men being very popular and also Lord of the Flies. So these books that you and I studied at school 20 plus years ago are still being studied today. Not a lot of change. There are more choices being put out there by the exam boards trying to, in their words, diversify the lists. But the reality is, unless you take off the old text that the teachers know and are familiar with, that people aren't going to change their choices. It's a bit sad, really, because it's a very limited curriculum. But I don't teach any of those texts because I don't have to. I work in an international school, so I can teach what I like, really. But I'm campaigning very hard as part of this organisation to get more diversity into the lists so that children are reading books that are more reflective of the world that they live in and the people that they are.
Amazing. I'm glad we got a chance to hear about that because I don't think you've talked about it on the podcast yet. So if people Google End Sexism in Schools, I'm sure they can find more information about what's been going on.
Yes, and you can read my two reports that I wrote. There you are.
There you go. And yes, on my list, 20 years ago, there were no women. Although my brother's parallel English class did read To Kill a Mockingbird, so at least he did one. Yeah. But I did not. Well, I suppose we probably had some in our poetry book, but yes. No full-length text by a woman. Hello, Simon popping on just to say thank you to everyone who supports us on Patreon. I'm going to pick some names at random from the list. Liana, Courtney, Jill, Harry, Jennifer, Kendall, Mindy, Alexandra. Gosh, there's so many of you. Bob. That'll do. You know who you are. Oh, and Heidi, lovely Heidi. Thanks so much to all of you for being part of the Patreon community. You can come and support the podcast at patreon.com/teaorbooks. Top tier, if you can get a book sent to you every month. Eliana, I do know I owe you some. I will send them. But anyone can get episodes a bit early, and indeed some exclusive news. For example, I've already told the Patreon community which author whom I love and Rachel loves is coming on the podcast in October. So excited when the publisher got in touch. But if you want to find out who that is, patreon.com/teaorbooks, or just, you know, wait for the future, I guess. And was I going to say anything else? Maybe just that you can find all the books and authors mentioned at stuckinabook.com, and you can find Rachel's Substack if you just Google Booksnob and Substack. I don't know the exact URL. Thanks so much for listening. Oh, rate and review, that was going to say, because we've had our first 1-star review. So there's that. So, you know, we've had a lot of 1-star ratings. It's our first 1-star review. So if you think we're worth more than 1-star, then why not find a way to review us? We'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much to those who have. It does mean a lot. Speak to you soon. Well, in fact, I'm going straight back to speak to you right now. Right, so on to those two books about shops, I guess. Which would you like to introduce us to?
I'm happy to do either, so you choose.
Okay, great. Well, I'll do Lady's Paradise then, because I've just read it.
All right, go ahead.
I should say my copy is translated by Brian Nelson. Did you have the same translation?
I did, yes.
Okay. And it's set in late 19th century Paris. Denise is an impoverished young woman with two younger brothers, one a little bit younger and one quite a lot younger, who has come to Paris seeking help from an uncle who sort of, when she was orphaned, sent a letter saying, you can come help us and be helped by us, but he didn't really mean it turns out. So they turn up there without any money, without really anything they can be useful at, although she has got some experience working in a shop. But her uncle, who runs a small shop, doesn't have any space for her to work. So instead, she gets a job at the Lady's Paradise, which is one of France's first department stores. It's run by a guy called Octave Mireille. Is that how I say it?
Okay.
And he is, I guess, the entrepreneur, I suppose. But he's got this vision for a shop that takes up a whole street, and it's got all the different departments together. It's got all the traditional shops encased in one, in a way that we would, I guess, not find that unfamiliar today, but was very novel at the time. And it's a long novel without huge amounts happening, and it's really a lot to do with the day-to-day experiences of Denise and other people in the shop. There is that romantic storyline that Rachel alluded to earlier, but it's really about how these traditional businesses that have been passed down from generation to generation were being outclassed and often put out of business by this dazzling new idea of the department store.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. So Babbicombe's is, as Simon said, by Nell Stretfield, but written under her pseudonym of Susan Scarlett, which she used for several, I would say, light romance novels in the early stage of her career. So Babbicombe's is also set in a department store in London somewhere. It's not specific, but they can walk home, and the family live in Battersea, so presumably in that area of London-ish. Also unclear on when it's supposed to be set, because it was published in the 40s, but I felt like it was happening in the sort of 1920s. I don't know whether you got a feel of that.
I didn't really think about it, actually.
From the descriptions of the clothes that the characters were wearing and the fact that they were taking the omnibus, I assumed we were looking more Edwardian, maybe early 20s. But anyway, that's by the by. It's certainly not set in the 1940s. Because there's no mention of a war. It's the plot hinges around Beth Carson, who has just finished school at the beginning of the novel, and her dad works in Babbicombe's, the a local department store, and he has got a job for her there. And Beth is initially a little bit disappointed because she's a scholarship girl. She's done really well at school and she would have liked to go off and become a secretary, but this is a guaranteed job. It's an opportunity for her. And so she goes and becomes an assistant in the gowns department. And on her very first day, she just so happens to bump into a very dashing young man and his dog, mm-hmm. who turns out to be David Babbicombe, the son of the owner of the department store, a very wealthy man. And the novel progresses from there about their relationship. There's also the arrival of the cousin, lovely little plot that comes in here. So there is a cousin that none of the Dulcie, who no one in the family's ever met. She's the daughter of Beth's dad's half brother, who's been living very far away for several years, and she has now finished school and wants to come to London and get a job. So they agree to take her in, and she also gets a job at Babbicombe's. But she is Beth's absolute opposite. She's flighty, flirtatious, ambitious, and she wants to take every opportunity to scupper Beth's opportunities with David Babbicombe. So there's also that element to the plot. And the novel looks at several months in Beth's life and the life of the shop as well. So yeah,
lovely. Yes, I was amazed by how similar these books were in many ways. I mean, they're very different reading experiences, I found, but they're both these very, very moralistic young women, both of whom I found I still liked spending time with them. And I think in the case of Beth, it's because she always speaks her mind and can't help it, and that sort of makes her sort of makes up for the quite often quite judgmental sort of goodness of her. And Denise, I guess it's something about how fearful and timid she is and how sort of overwhelmed by the world that made me feel a bit protective towards her. So yeah, even though neither on the face of it have any flaws, they are not annoying people to be around. And yeah, they both have these slight slightly feckless powerful men who begin to fall in love with them and whilst also being all about department stores. So yeah, very, but so different in the reading experiences because, yeah, as I said, The Lady's Paradise is very long and very unhurried, like this, often scenes that just at length with this clearly immaculate research about what goes on in a draper's section of a department store or how shifts work or who decides who goes and helps the next customer or how much commission you get, all these sorts of things are just in there in such intricate detail. Whereas we get some of the department store detail in Babbicombe's, but the romance is much more prominent, I think, is much more about the characters and the department store as a background. Whereas The Lady's Paradise almost felt about the department store and the characters were just happened to be there. Did you feel that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I was reading Babbicombe's yesterday and I was quite taken aback actually by how much of the plot was the romance plot certainly was very similar, and the characters, the dilemma of both of these women who come from lower class backgrounds and who can't possibly be with this sort of big important person that they've fallen in love with. And I also found it interesting having that choice to make it about these very moralistic, very correct women who were not going to compromise themselves and their beliefs and their morals in order to be captured by these, dissident men. I mean, David's nothing wrong with David. He's just not particularly ambitious for himself at the beginning of the novel, but he soon sees himself right. And Octave Moret as well. I mean, he's not done anything wrong necessarily other than being quite ambitious for himself. But also there's been, I guess he's had lots of affairs with women, which Denise is very upset by. But I just thought to myself, Babbicombe's felt like a very cheap copy of The Lady's Paradise in some ways. It was like she'd kind of lifted that element of it and thought, oh, you know what, I'm going to write a book set in a
in a shop as well, but I'm going to focus on the romance. It just felt too uncanny to be, you know, because she's also working in the dress department, like Denise works in the dress department. And there's, as you say, there's some elements in Babbicombe's of the running of the shop and how it works. Like I found it interesting that Beth also is on this kind of commission basis like Denise. I mean, I loved the description in The Lady's Paradise of how it worked, because I had no idea. And the same in Babbicombe's, when you go in as a junior, you just get a sort of basic salary, and this system whereby, you know, you're on a rota, and you can't just go up to any old customer who walks in the shop. You know, you've got the names on the list, and you've got to wait your turn to go for a sale, and all of the infighting amongst the people of like, oh no, I'm going to fob this rubbish customer off on you, who I know is not going to spend any money, which means you won't get any commission, and then I'll take the next customer. And that was fascinating to me, understanding how all of that works. And also the very business element of The Lady's Paradise, of this novel idea of setting up a one-stop shop for everything, and of working out basically of, I mean, it's kind of like an Amazon style selling it like process, in that you knowingly sell at a loss, but you sell so much volume that in the end you do make a profit. And profit isn't the important thing, it's about getting the customers in the shop. So Moray comes up with all of these ideas about selling cheap stuff at the front of the shop at a loss in order to entice people in. And those descriptions of the displays and the sales and his the difficulties with individual employees. I mean, I just found it fascinating. I mean, I am the daughter of a self-made businessman, so business was something that was talked about at home all the time growing up. And the problems with it, and with all my dad's employees, and you know, all of the issues that he was having and everything else, and how he was going to overcome problems. And I just found in Octave Moray that wonderful kind of drive and ambition, but then also his Achilles heel, which is that everything is nothing to him unless he has people around him who he loves. And when he's decided that Denise is that person, the shop suddenly and the money that he's making doesn't matter anymore. And I think that's also really interesting for the time that the book is written. I mean, it's one of Zola's kind of cycle of novels about Paris and about the enormous changes that were happening in Paris at that time, when Haussmann was knocking down all the old parts of Paris and rebuilding it all, and thinking about what is modernity and what are we sacrificing, and that exploration of the poor other shopkeepers in the neighborhood who don't stand a chance against this behemoth that's been set up, and Denise's practicality in being like, well, this is the future, it's happening, it's coming, there's nothing we can do about it. And that social element of the novel, of social history, I found fascinating, which I didn't really feel was there at all in Babbicombe's. And in fact, I felt it was a little bit almost regressive in some ways, especially as we have the introduction of our aristocratic characters, and we go off to a castle for the weekend, and then, you know, everyone's engaged, and isn't it lovely?
Yeah, it's interesting your mention of Amazon there, because we're in an era now where the department store is shutting down, or has shut down. So in the UK, Debenhams was our sort of big chain department store, and they went to the wall a few years ago. And obviously, there's a lot of people mourning the disappearance of the high street, whether that is the department store or individual shops. There's a disappearance of the high street in a different way, and The Lady's Paradise. But, you know, it's really, I found it fascinating to see the department store as a bright future, whereas in an era where we see it as the fading past, you know, 100 or so years later. So it had a good run, but yeah, I had to get my mindset into the idea that the department store was something new and exciting. I did find all the independent shopkeepers we saw were just slightly unbelievably heroic. And I know we will fight on to the death. I will keep my shoddy umbrella stand even whilst they build around me. Even if they're offering me hundreds of thousands of francs, I shan't leave. And I mean, obviously some of them have left instantly and we don't hear their stories. But yeah, the plucky underdog characters were alternatively sad or, you know, admirable. But yeah, I thought maybe a little contrived, perhaps. I guess that's the thing, because everything's contrived in Babbicombe's, and that's fine because you know what sort of book you're reading. And yes. I enjoyed that they got, you know, she the main romantic couple gets stuck in a lift together, which feels so 1990s. You can just imagine Meg Ryan getting stuck in a lift with someone, can't you? But it's, you know, here it is.
With what's his face? Tom. I can't think of his name.
Tom Hanks.
That's it.
Yes, yes, exactly. Indeed, mean, they did that little shop around the corner, didn't they? But yeah. they didn't call it that. You've Got Mail. That's what they call it.
Yes.
Yes. So it's definitely a rom com. You know, she doesn't know at first that he's David Babbicombe, but the reader knows the second that he's mentioned. He's got an adorable dog called Scissors. Great name for a dog. Love the dog. It's basically, as you say, it's sort of a Pale Imitation, but it's also trying to do something different. It is just fun nonsense, whereas yes, Lady's Paradise is going back to what we were talking about just now, I thought it was fascinating that Zola is clearly such a brilliant writer and is writing about something that, if it, in the English novel at the time, I think would have been considered a waste of an excellent writer's time. So it's interesting. I don't know anything really about the 19th century French novel, but the fact that he was able to write in such loving detail about shopping and about society women and fabric and all these things that I just don't think an English novelist would have got away with doing that. So I thought that was really interesting, or an English male novelist particularly at that time, and had it considered great literature. So that was really interesting to me.
Yeah, I asked my French friend about it, and she said that, you know, Zola was always very well respected in France as a sort of social novelist, and certainly not the equivalent. She said he's not the equivalent of Dickens.
Okay,
that would be Balzac.
So who is he the equivalent of?
I think maybe somebody more like Trollope.
Okay.
Someone who was looking at the political and the social side of society, and writing in a much more like my friend explained. So Balzac, for example, he was like Dickens in that his books were published in serials, whereas Zola never. He always published straight up as a novelist. So that was kind of a different quality from the start. But I think, you know, Zola is interested very much in social history, and he's very interested in his Parisian novels. He's interested in recording this moment in time. And I think that's where the detail comes in. You know, he did so much research about how department stores worked, and he based this novel on, you know, real figure. So looking at wanting to get all the detail right was really important to him, which is where you have that more sort of bloated 19th century novel feel, where it's, you have got three pages devoted to describing exactly what this display looks like, which I loved all the detail of it. So, but I could see how other people would just be like, oh, come on, just get on with the story, you know. And the main thrust of the story about, you know, will these poor shopkeepers survive? What will happen? You know, will the shop keep expanding? Will he get the money and the investment to keep going? I mean, yes, there is, these characters are, you know, poor old me sitting in my little hovel. What can I do? I'm just going to keep going and, you know, digging myself deeper and deeper into bankruptcy because I won't be defeated by this man. I mean, it does just look like sheer obstinance, but at the same time, I do wonder whether that was an accurate reflection of how people felt at the time. You know, when you've got a novel thing coming in, you know, will it last? I mean, when you think about, you know, the advent of the internet, did people think that internet shopping would take over from real life shopping and going to the high street? Probably not. But over time, things overtake you and you don't realize what you're up against. So I thought that was interesting, if, you know, but it was a very 19th century way of looking at it. And obviously, you know, that everyone dies of, you know, of TB and whatever, and shadow of this awful shop that's robbed them of all their daylight and everything else. So I mean, I thought that some of it was a little bit melodramatic, but you know, what can you expect from a 19th century novel? But I think with Babbicombe's, I really enjoyed reading it. Like, I sound like I'm being down on it. You know, it was a lovely read, lovely way to spend an afternoon.
But I felt that Dulcie's character was just so contrived, and she's literally brought into the novels so that there can be a mix-up with the fact that Babbicombe, Mr. Babbicombe, runs the shop, gets confused between Dulcie Carson and Beth Carson because he doesn't realise there's two Carson girls. And so when Dulcie is very naughty at the staff Christmas party, some things never change, he can legitimately, you know, make a big mess up and ban his son, and it can all go wrong, etc. I should say these are plot spoilers, sorry everyone. So it's that for me, like, I thought the novel was well written and well plotted and everything, apart from that element, which I just felt that it was, I could see that when you can see that someone's only in the book to function as something, and there's no depth to that character, I thought there could have been something much, much more to her.
And yeah, I did feel a bit uncomfortable with how she was treated in general, because, you know, she's made out to be this villain because she wants to look nice, basically. Yeah. And, you know, she's not particularly hardworking, but she's treated quite shoddily in a way that I don't think she would be today. And then, as you say, in Lady's Paradise, some characters who clearly just exist to die. I did think, considering it's so long as a book, it's surprising how little we learn about Denise's brothers or about her uncle and cousins who sort of come in when they're needed for a plot point. There's and a very moving part towards the end, but I feel like you could have laced them through a bit more, because you sort of forget about them for, you know, 100 pages at a time.
Could have just got rid of them altogether, really. I mean, what a lot of these 19th century novelists needed was a good editor, really. But there we
I know it was adapted about 10 years ago for the BBC or someone, I don't know because as you say, it's so much about description, about visuals, about you know, day-to-day life rather than plot, that I guess they probably amped up the plot and maybe spent less time talking about different fabrics.
We added in a few more interpersonal relationships, but I think there is a fascination, isn't there, I think with reading about workplaces, especially workplaces that a lot of us are familiar with as users, but not necessarily as being behind the scenes. I mean, people are obsessed with reading books about police detectives, aren't they, and doctors and things like that. People love having access to behind the scenes of this world that's very familiar to them, but of which they have no direct experience. Now, I think exploring that behind the scenes of the shop and the decisions that go on and what happens, particularly in a time period that's really quite removed from now, and I'm sure most of us have at some point worked in retail. I know I certainly have. And so it's something that we know, but looking at how it was developed in the early ages of it, I found really interesting sort of understanding about also in The Lady's Paradise, how they explore the social side of the shop and the provisions made for the staff, the fact that the women slept in the shop, that they had a canteen, that they had all of these things laid on for them, about doctors and a library and social spaces, etc. You know, it was very much their world.
Yeah, I was quite surprised by that.
Yeah, and I found that really interesting as well, and not something that I sort of loosely knew elements of it, but not that much. So I just found it really fascinating. I got quite drawn into it, but I quite agree with you. I mean, half of each chapter could have been gone.
Yeah, and I think sometimes when something goes that deep into the sort of unnecessary detail, then you're just like, okay, that's the novel I'm in, that's the world I'm in. I don't think I'd have wanted it to be shorter, because the point was the excess in some way.
Yeah.
And if it was half this length, I think it would just be an unsuccessful, like, novel with not enough plot. But because he's just like, okay, yeah, I'm going to spend 3 pages telling you about this display, then I'm like, sure, okay, that's the world I'm in, and I'll go with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was
nice to be immersed in it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it did feel, and it, you know, it did feel, wasn't a page turner, but I did feel like I was immersed in that world for a long time. I mostly read it on the plane to and from Scotland, so. Yeah. And various different evenings in Scotland. And yeah, I thought the, you know, the translation seemed good. There was one bit I wanted to highlight because it amused me as being the only sort of very awkward bit of the translation. Quite early in the book, it says, about Denise talking to her uncle. However, when he heard what she told him about her brothers, he used the familiar second person singular. And he used the familiar second person singular, I assume is it tutoyer is the word meaning to use to instead of vous?
Yes.
Which obviously is something in French, is not something in English. And that's an example where I think I probably just put he was more familiar with her, or he spoke to her more familiarly or something, rather than that's a slightly jarring moment.
It's really tricky. I mean, I do translation from French sometimes, and it's with plays, and it is really hard when a character is to-ing and voo-ing different people, and how can you show in English that there is a difference, and you can't. So yeah,
for those who don't know, voo is sort of the formal you, and to is the informal you, broadly.
If you're deliberately voo-ing someone in a familiar situation, that's a snub, and it's very difficult to get that across in English without having to, it's very hard because we don't have that distinction. So it's that's interesting. I thought the translation by and large, bless Simon asked if I was going to be reading it in French, and I
believed in you. Yeah.
I just sent him a tears of laughter emoji. I can't read 19th century French, it's too hard for me. I would like to have a look at the original and compare it a little bit, but my French friend, who I ask about all literary matters, said that he is a really good writer, but not necessarily a stylist like Flaubert, so you're not necessarily kind of going to be missing anything huge.
Okay.
I thought it read very well, and I didn't really notice I should have been reading it in French, which I think is always a good thing.
Speaking of the formality thing, earlier in the year I read Strangers by Tiichi Yamada, that was turned into the film All of Us Strangers, a Japanese novel. And again, they were sort of struggling in the translation to convey I think there's several different registers, or I don't know what the correct word is, different levels of formality that you can use that affect verb endings and that sort of thing. And that there's these different parent-child characters who are getting to know each other more. And there was a whole maze of things that would have been conveyed in Japanese by the grammar or the word choice that was not able to be done in English, where we use the same words for everyone.
Yes, I mean, in some ways English is very complicated, and in others it's just very simple.
Yeah. It's just weird given how obsessed we are with class as as a nation. We just do it with our eyebrows rather than our grammar. Teal Books, Decision Making Time, you're walking into a department store. Which one are you walking into?
I think for me it's got to be the Ladies' Paradise.
I was really on the fence because Ladies' Paradise is inarguably the better novel, but there was something just so perfect about Babbicombe's. I think Ladies' Paradise is better, Babbicombe's is just such a perfect little gem of nonsense joy that I would happily reread whenever. I think I'm going to go with Babbicombe's.
I can understand that. I mean, her family are wonderful. It was very lovely. I spent, and it's a very quick read.
Scissors the dog, yeah.
Scissors the dog.
They're both wonderful. I love them both in very different ways, but
I also loved I should have mentioned this earlier, but I also loved the use of the dentist as an undercover way to meet.
Yes. Or the eye operation I could have lived without. But anyway, let's not dwell on that.
No.
Well, that was fun. And sorry if anyone went read High Wages in preparation, but you can go back and listen to whichever episode we did High Wages in. In the next episode, we will be doing two of the British Library Women Writers books as we get ready for the Marlborough Literary Festival. They are One Year's Time by Angela Milne and Which Way? By Theodora Benson. We look forward to talking to you then.
See you then. Thanks for listening.
Bye.